Accession number 8667, rule number 8.
Mr. Barton, reel 8.
Yes, there used to be a medical team come round, or periodically, I think, to just have a look through the men to see if they could find anybody who was fit enough to mark A1 or fit for duty other than on this prisoner of war camp business, which was the lowest of the low.
Did you feel it was the lowest of the low, or was...
Oh, yes. Yes, actually, having been on active service and seen fighting and what I'd been through, it seemed to be, absolutely scraping the bottom of the barrel to be put into this Royal Defence Corps, which had a badge, simply RDF, and a flat badge that looked like a postman's badge, and we were not supposed to wear our ordinary insignia of the battalion to which we originally belonged. Now, I had still got all my badges and shoulder badges of the Royal Fusiliers, and when I went out an evening after leaving the camp, I used to quickly take out the RFC badge and put in my Royal Fusilier badge and my shoulder badge on my epaulettes as well, so that I walked round as a Royal Fusilier, not as a Royal Defence Corps private. And
how did members of the public view you then in the Royal Defence Corps?
They didn't think anything of the Royal Defence Corps. They thought they really were, if you'd have seen them, the lowest of the low. I've got nothing against them, but they had no military discipline or anything else. They were just, used for guard duties, and that was all. I think they were used also on guarding railways and things like that, but they had no military training or discipline. Sorry, Dad. They had no military training or anything. So the one or two fellows like myself who had been abroad and seen active service, it was, really being sent right down to the bottom of the class to be in this group. But there was nothing you could do about it. They wouldn't discharge you. You could perform a useful job. And that was it.
Were any of your fellow workers ever taken back into active service as a result of these other medical examinations?
I don't know that they were put onto active service, but they might be put onto a more useful service, you see. Something that was more active, although they weren't sent overseas. They might have been put onto more active service. But it all depended upon their fitness and whether their injuries or wounds had recovered sufficiently. But they couldn't do anything about my eyesight. They couldn't increase that or put that right, so they couldn't do anything about me. And I would have been very glad to have got out of it, but they wouldn't discharge me. Anyway,
what news were you hearing of the war at this point?
Well, we got all the local papers, we got all the daily papers and everything else with all the latest news that was happening in 1918, and of course we realised that we were gradually coming towards the end. And everybody began to be talking about what we were going to do when we were discharged, and what sort of life we were going to take up. We joined up as young men, and now we were of 19, and now here we were 22 and 23, to start life afresh. And we were worried about what we were going to do. Anyway, the time got on towards the armistice. The talk was about the armistice, all the negotiations were going on. And then, of course, we finally heard that on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the armistice was going to be declared. And we were all looking forward to that with great eagerness. And of course, when the time came, on that 11th day, pandemonium broke loose. Everybody went mad. Work finished, all the factories poured out, sirens went, crowds rushed round the streets, and just pandemonium broke loose. Even in the camp, there was no discipline or anything. Everybody just broke loose. I think they let the prisoners out and everything else into the compound, and they all joined up and all joined together and celebrated. And I know I got out and went into town, and I was swamped with people, and all the pubs and everything else was full up. And I believe that evening, if I remember, I went to Bolton Hippodrome with my wife, and there was a theatre, this Bolton Hippodrome, and there was a man there who played the organ. His name was Patman, P-A-T-T-M-A-N, and he used to travel around with one of these Wurlitzer organs, and we had a wonderful time in that theatre that night, singing all the patriotic songs. Well, that eventually calmed down, and we went back to camp, waiting to know what was going to happen. This was November, and of course everybody was talking about being discharged, but it was a long while before the discharges came through, and there was only so many. You had to apply for a discharge, and I think they went from our place, from our camp, they went to Chester, where they had to look through your records and find out what you'd done and where you'd been and one thing and another, and finally your discharge would come through. But I was so useful in this blooming camp and orderly room that the captain wouldn't sign my papers. He wouldn't let them go through. And while other chaps were getting discharged, I was still stuck in this blooming camp. So one day, anyway, I filled up my discharge papers and slipped them in amongst several others that were going through. And the captain, who very rarely read anything, he just signed it, he signed my papers, and they went through to Chester. And two or three days afterwards, my discharge came through. He was furious, and so was the sergeant. They were all furious that I'd got the discharge and I was going to leave them. But they couldn't do anything about it because the papers were signed. And eventually I packed up and departed. And where I went then, and I had to go to somewhere to get the discharge, but I can't remember where it was. It was on my discharge certificate, dear. I forget where we had to go to. Anyway, there was a certain camp where we had to go and be properly discharged. We had to hand in our uniform, and we were supplied with a civvy suit and civvy clothes, if you wanted it. I think you could take your uniform home, I believe. I think you could go home in your uniform, and then you were given vouchers to go and purchase a civvy suit, I think, in the end. And then, of course, you got your vouchers to join to get your bonus. You got a bonus of £5 a year for each year that you served. So, of a 5-year service, I received the magnificent sum of £25. And I believe if you didn't take the voucher for the suit, I think you got a voucher for £30 if you didn't take the ticket for the suit. 30 shillings for a suit. Anyway, I can't remember where that camp was, but I know I did eventually get home, and I think they gave us a week's leave with pay, and then came the transition to back to civilian life. I went back to the firm that I had left in 1914 and applied for my job back, They agreed to give it to me, but they pointed out that when I left in 1914, I was 19 and I was earning £1 a week. Now I was 23 and married. I'd been away all the 5 years, and I was no more use to them when I come back than what I was when I left, which was perfectly true. But after some argument, they agreed to re-engage me, and they gave me £2.10 a week.
Had they made any promises to you when you signed up?
No. No, they've made no promises that they would take us back at all. There was no promise on that, and they didn't have to. I mean, there was no directive from the government that they should agree to re-employ you when you come back. Not with any companies, as far as I remember. There was no agreement on that at all. You just took your chance. Of course, many big firms and corporations and, say, people like school teachers and all that, they did receive the assurance that they would get their jobs back. But in private firms, commercial firms, there was no guarantee of that at all. It was quite up to the firm to decide whether they would agree to take you back or not. And as my firm pointed out, I was worth no more to them when I returned than I was when I left, having had no experience that was useful for them. And when I went back to my firm, when I left it in 1914, it's quite a large firm, there was only one woman on the firm, and that was an old cleaner of about 70. When I came back, the firm were full of women. Nearly all the jobs had been taken over by women. So they didn't look upon us with much favour when we returned, because we wanted our jobs back, which meant that they would lose their jobs. So we weren't in very much favour then.
Did the women lose their jobs?
Oh, yes. Because I think the firms felt that they had to give the chaps their jobs back. Oh, I think one or two papers took it up and said that they'd got to. It was only right that they should. And the women had to go, and you took over the job that you did before.
Had you expected to be able to get your job back? Had you thought?
Oh, yes. We quite thought that we would get our jobs back, having worked for the firm for some years before we joined up. And the talk was that the men would get their jobs back, but the firms weren't too willing to, really, a lot of them anyway, because things weren't very good, and nobody knew what was going to happen quite, how business was going to be or anything else. But so things were a bit dodgy. Anyway, I got my job back. My wife came to London with me, and I believe we managed to secure... It was a job to find anywhere to live. I believe we managed, after a time, to find two small rooms at 17 and 6 a week, I think. We had to pay for that. And I think my wife got a little job somewhere as well to try and make ends meet, because we had to start trying buying one or two things to get our home together. And I was, but in my firm, I was in the export department. Then, of course, the export business had gone up the spout, so there wasn't much business to be done. And it wasn't very, I think it was, I went back there perhaps in the February or something like that, February or March, and I'd got fed up with it by the August, and I saw another job advertised in the paper, and I applied for that. And from a firm of stationers in Tottenham, and I applied for the job and I got it, and it was 10 shillings a week more, which was quite a lot then, £3 a week. And I got this job, and I stayed with them for 50 years with that firm. But that covers a lot of ground and a lot of other stories.
What about the talk of reconstruction in those days following the armistice?
Well, there was a lot of talk, and a talk of land fit for heroes to live in. But it was a long while coming. Matter of fact, I don't think he's come yet. But housing was in very short supply, and nobody seemed to know quite what to do. I think the chaps who come back from the army, of course, so many of them couldn't get jobs, and they'd got no money to start their homes off, and many of them had got married, the same as I had, and it was a job to scrape any money together. I worked in Holborn. I lived in Kentish Town, and I worked in Holborn. It was a distance of say 3 or 4 miles, and the fare, the tram fare from Kentish Town to Holborn, was 3 halfpence each way, and I used to walk that in the morning and back again in the evening to save that threepence a day. That's how tight things were. If it was wet, well, I'd have just a penny ride to King's Cross and then walk from King's Cross to Holborn. But that's how we had to manage in those days. A penny was a lot of money.
How did you feel about it after those war years?
Well, I felt a bit sick about it, really. We felt that you'd had all those years and that nobody really cared. There was a lot of talk, but there didn't seem to be much done for you. That I don't think anybody really had a plan. I was only young then, and I wasn't interested in politics and all that sort of thing very much. But I remember at the time there was a lot of trouble with people out of work and couldn't get work, and a great deal of poverty. But I know we struggled and managed one way and another, saving a halfpenny here and a penny there. It was a terrific struggle for a time, for some years really, before you could sort of feel your feet. A question of getting rooms. Well, if you were lucky, if you could find 2 rooms or 3 rooms. I mean, today people start with houses, washing machines and every blooming thing. But in those days, if you started with 2 rooms and £25, if anybody got married with £25, they were considered wealthy. And that's all they would have to start their life on. 2 rooms and £25. And buy a few sticks of furniture. And then that's normal people. That's not poor people. I'm not talking right down to the bottom of the ladder. That was the normal person's start in life. Hardly anybody in those days bought their own houses. It was all rent. My family were quite a indecent position, but of all my relations, I don't remember any of them buying their own houses. They all rented their places. I know my father did, and I think he paid the first house that I remember, he paid 7 and 6 a week for, and then he moved to another one which was about 12 and 6 a week, and I think that when I came out of the army he was paying about 17 and 6 a week for quite a nice house. There was very little buying your own house in those days. That's why things have changed so much now. Nowadays, people seem to spend their lives decorating their houses and making alterations to them, and goodness knows what. But in those days, you didn't do any of that. The landlord did the decorations. I never remember seeing my father with a paintbrush in his hand, or he wouldn't know how to use it, which end was to paint with. Things have changed completely since those days. It's so difficult to describe it all.
You say you weren't particularly interested in politics. Mm-hmm. Did you take any interest in the peace conference and the negotiations that were going on?
No, I can't say that I did. I can't remember taking any action in that really at all. No, I'm...
Do you remember what your hopes were for future peace?
Well, we hoped that there would never be another war. Everybody said, oh, there'll never be another war. I've got a certificate from our local church saying, thank God our boy will never have to fight. What a laugh that was. But there seemed to be so much argument and bickering going on that nobody seemed to have a definite plan. I mean, I've read about all these plans since, but I can't remember what my thoughts were at that particular time. I know that we were pretty well concerned with struggling to live, struggling to get on. And we hadn't got much faith in what the politicians were trying to do. We'd heard of all the failures that had happened during the war in the various campaigns. I mean, people were full about the failure of Gallipoli and failure of other attacks on the Somme and places like that, where there were so many hundreds of thousands of men were killed. Every family had lost, I suppose every family in the land had lost some loved one. The whole thing was overshadowed with the awesomeness of that war and the tremendous losses, and it completely changed the outlook of your life, that you really couldn't see what was going to be the future. You could only work and hope.